Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Okay, so in the interest of time, the show is also sponsored by reclaimingtherepublic.org as well as republicreview.org. And as you know, I mentioned this in the last episode, that we will be covering an interview with Brent Alan Winters in this coming episode. Brent has got a book published, and we'll get into the details of that book. But I wanted to give you an insight as to why we've got Brent on. And it's important that as we start looking at restoring our constitutional republic, one of the things that also has to be restored, just like I said in the previous, the militia has to be restored. That's an integral part. Well, we also need to restore common law, and you need to understand what common law is. And so in doing that, what we want to do is I asked Brent in this interview to try to give us some basic background, fundamentals on common law. So we've got two actual interviews. So we're going to interview him today, and then we will interview him tomorrow in our next episode. This way you can get some insights on common law. We don't cover all of it, and it takes a long time to help, because these are things that are absolutely foreign. It's like speaking a different language. All the different types of laws out there, and I didn't even get into that yet with Brent, but I want, because there's contract law, there's admiralty law, there's the laws of nations or the UN laws, and there's all these contrived laws, and he basically boils them down into two types of laws. There's the law of the land and the law of the city, but I will let him get into all of those types of details. But bottom line, I know you're going to find this interesting. This is very interesting dialogue. You're going to want to earmark this so that you can digest all of this information and even maybe look up the scriptures that Mr. Winters cites so that you kind of have a better understanding of how important common law is if we're going to be a civil and a just society, because both of those depend upon liberty. Civility and justice depends upon liberty, because we have to be a people of liberty so that we're willing to be accountable and responsible for the decisions we make. Liberty is not freedom, as you know. And so we're going into a hard break, so we'll have this one promo, and we will be right back with Mr. Winters. And then after Mr. Winters and I have this first interview segment, we will then come right back and give you some insights on his book. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open. All right, folks, I am back with Brent Winters, and Brent Winters is, I'll just say this, he's the primary resource for the National Liberty Alliance regarding common law. He's written a book regarding common law, and I will get you the details after the end of this segment of this interview so that you can go and look up, because I don't want to necessarily, you know, not hold that information, because I believe you're going to find all sorts of little fruit that you are going to want to partake of out of his book. So with that, Brent, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Good to be here, of course. And it's a pleasure to talk to you. And it's a pleasure to talk to your audience, because I figure they're kind of a special audience.
Well, if they're putting up with me, then they are special.
And they're interested in the subject of which you are interested, apparently.
Yes, the Constitution and actually saving it. That's why the name of the show is called Reclaiming the Republic. Uh-huh. Anyway, what got you started? Did you start with law, or your background professionally is... I'll let you fill in the blanks.
The thing that I know most about in life, and have always known most about in life, is raising livestock. I don't hesitate to say it, and as I get older, I like it more. I wish I were doing it now. I know how to dirt farm, and I know how to raise cattle and horses and hogs. But there's a lot of lessons in that. But from that, I ended up as a military man, and I was affiliated for 12 years, almost 13 years, as a Navy man. And then also, after that, I ended up being a geologist. And I worked out west in the mines. I went into doing that at first because I thought I'd work in the oil patch. My father and a lot of my family had always worked in the oil patch. I grew up in the oil patch, as they say at home. And I thought I'd do that. Well, that didn't work out. The oil patch at home had begun to play out. Not that the oil was gone, it's just that they hadn't figured out how to get it yet. We lived in an oil patch where the oil wells were only a few hundred feet deep. It was an early one, but it's once a patch plays out like that, people don't realize 80% of the oil is still there. You just have to figure out how to get it. The gravy comes first, the easy stuff. But I ended up working in the hard rock mineral mining out west, gold and some silver. And then after that, I was raising a family, and I got involved in a situation in the mining fields. And a fellow that I'd end up being partners with, he was my age, and he was from Kansas. My father's age, I meant to say. Same age as my father. He's gone now. Of course, in the mining business, if you think you've got something, everybody, their brother, their dog, and anybody that looks like them thinks they have some legal claim to it, too. So the lawsuits came. In one particular instance, and this fella, who now would be 94 years old, he was younger then, that's been over 30 years ago. He said, Brent, if we're going to continue doing this, one of us is going to have to go to law school, and it isn't going to be me. So I ended up going to law school. At that time, I had six children, and I had more later, but I had six at that time, and I knew it would be an expensive endeavor. And he said, look, if you get in a pinch, you're taking care of the property and taking care of the mining property that we had, the claims. He said, get in a pinch and let me know if you're in a pinch, and I'll see if I can help you. Well, he didn't bankroll me, but I got in a pinch a couple of times, and he was able to help me, and I was able to get through law school. By the way, that's the way education is supposed to work. Education is supposed to work when people think there's something important in an education, and the benefactors of a man's country is what enables him to have an education. He doesn't do it himself. No, there must be someone that helps fund his education. That's not kept at the top of our consciousness. I don't care who you are, and I don't care how rich you may be. Somebody's funding your education somehow, some way. Somebody's willing to make it happen. Well, that happened, and I ended up going to law school. And I was interested, of course, in mining law, all sorts of mining law, the fundamentals of it. And I still am interested. And the reason I'm interested in mining law, which includes oil, gas, and gold and silver and iron ore or whatever comes out of the ground. By the way, everything we have comes out of the ground, and that's the way God intended it. And he wants us to feel attached and to understand that we're attached to the land, whether you feel it or not. It's really not, I guess, important. What's important is that he wants us to know that he has chosen to provide for us through the land that the Lord thy God has given to us. That's how he does it. And he does that with every tribe, tongue, and people on the faces of the earth. Whether they acknowledge it or not, most of them don't, of course. But there is great joy in understanding that and understanding our relationship to the land. By the way, I must say one other thing. Love of country is not love of government. Love of country is not love of even your neighbor. As important as that is, love of country is love of your land, because it is your maker who gave it to you, and he wants you to love it, and he wants you to take care of it. And I've noticed that our songs, our so-called patriotic songs, have left that theme. And the songs that are popular now do not speak of love of land. They speak of love of flag or some other such thing. That's not what patriotism is. In fact, the word patriotism, it's an old Anglo word, an old Germanic word. It means love of the land, and not only that, love of not the motherland, as the French used to say, and as we got through the Norman invasion of 1066, but love of fatherland. It's masculine, not feminine. It's masculine in the Hebrew tongue in the Older Testament, and it's masculine also in our own tongue, our own Anglo tongue. It is love of fatherland, and God does not want us to worship fatherland. He wants us to love fatherland, and that's where patriotism has its stability. It will have its stability no other place, and if we choose to look for patriotism any other place, it won't last, because men are fickle. Do we love one another? Oh, to the degree that God tells us to, but that's not what patriotism is. Well, at any rate, I began in... I'd raised livestock when I was... raised my family and farming, dirt farming, and I went off to law school, and I came back, and I've done several things in life since then. Like one fellow said, who was it? John Wayne said, I've done everything but keep school. Well, I haven't kept school, although I did substitute teach once. I tried it. Somebody talked me into it. I didn't want to do that anymore. It was in the local high school, and it was more than I can deal with to deal with what was going on there. And this was in small town America, a town of 1,200 people. So that's my background. I've done litigation in federal court, state court, tried cases before the jury in both of those, clerk for an appellate judge back a long time ago. And I've filed and drafted and filed petitions in the U.S. Supreme Court. I've helped other people draft and file petitions because they didn't. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. But those are the kind of things I've done. And I've written a book, as you had mentioned, a comparative law text called Excellence of the Common Law, in light of history, in light of nature, and in light of the Bible. In light of the Bible. And the reason I do it in light of the Bible also is because our country has claimed two fundamental volumes of law. Those two fundamental volumes are the laws of nature, which is the lex non scripta, the law not written, and number two, the laws of nature's God, which Blackstone continues to tell us that's the law written, which is the Bible. That's the flat facts of the matter. If we stray from those, we will find hardship and judgment. Period. End of sentence, end of paragraph.
Okay. All right. So one of the things that you made a comment on, because you were talking about love of land and its essence of patriotism, one of the things that I think the framers understood exactly what you said, that man is fickle, that man will change his perspective and can easily be enamored and, you know, fall in love with their politicians, such as Obama, Trump, and what have you. But I think the framers understood that. And as a matter of fact, I won't even say that. I will assert that the divine hand of providence ensured the perspective of patriotism in this newfound country that they were creating would be kept myopic on the Constitution, which is why they required that every public servant raise their arm to the square and take an oath to the Constitution, not take oath to the president, not take oath to the governor, not take oath to any person, body of government, to the Constitution. And that's also why at the immigration process, when a person naturalizes, when they take an oath of citizenship, the first thing they do is they, whatever you call it, they no longer acknowledge any allegiance to any other state or potentiary or, you know, master, and acknowledge their, you know, their obligation to supporting the Constitution. Again, not a politician, government, or what have you. And so the modern day definition of patriotism is vigorously support of one's country. So around the world, a patriot is a person who supports their country. In America, patriotism has been redefined, and the patriot in America is one who is supporting the Constitution.
Well, you make a point about all of that, and those are questions. What you've said raises questions, begs questions that we must grapple with, but I want to say up front, there are sure answers to these questions. This is not something that's a matter of opinion. When the Constitution of the United States says, for instance, that it is the supreme law of the land, that phrase, law of the land, means common law. That's all it's ever meant. It was lifted right out of Magna Carta. It had existed before Magna Carta. That was their admission and their assertion that this Constitution is our common law. Let me add this, too. I believe it was in the year 17 and... I get the years mixed up. It was at Annapolis, Maryland, when Congress first assembled. I believe it was 1775. I know it was on the 14th of October. The 14th of October. And
yes,
they said...
Yes, it was 75, yeah.
Okay, 75, and they wrote a letter. They drafted a letter, all signed it, wrote it to the big shots over in the what they call the mother country. You see, there's that French influence coming in there. I was taught that in the first grade. That was from the Norman Frenchmen. No, the Normans who lived on the coast of France, they were from Norway, the people were. They invaded England. They were Norwegians. But they had taken on the French tongue. It became motherland because that's what the French tongue, that's the gender the French tongue puts to it. You say, Brent, you're making a big deal about that. Well, yes, I am, simply because accuracy is important, and I'm trying to stress one particular point. It is the land that's important. We even sing. The older songs say, God bless America, the land I love. That was the emphasis, because that was who we were, and it was hard to change, and we thought that way. We're not thinking that way now. The land that I love, stand beside her, guide her through the night with the light from above. That is a statement of biblical Christianity of no mean proportions. But back to the men at Annapolis that had assembled in Congress, they wrote a letter back to England. And they said, we demand, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially what they said was, we demand the freedoms, the rights, that means the duties, by the way, of our Constitution. Now, the Constitution wouldn't have been drafted for another 11 years, but they demanded the rights to their Constitution. Well, what did they mean by that? They meant their Constitution, which Englishmen still yet today call, the Brits even, Wales, Northern Ireland, they call that their common law. It is their common law that is their constitution. It was our constitution at that time. And so what our constitution of the United States did was nothing new, nothing new. It was just an institution applied in the new world of the principles of our common law. Fundamental things that don't exist anywhere else in the world. Separation of powers, independence of the judiciary, stare decisis, the right to keep and bear arms. You don't find that in other places in the world like you find it here. No. You don't find the right to remain silent. Go to Sweden and see if you can say what you want to say. No, they're under the Roman law. There are only two possibilities in the world. And this is the simplicity that will keep men from the doctrines of demons. There are only two possibilities. There is either the law of the land, that's our law, our Constitution calls it that, or there is the law of the city. It's impossible to even begin to understand our Constitution and put it in place if you don't see that it is informed entirely and freights everything that the common law is. The Mexicans, they had a constitution, the Constitution of 1824. And they said, this constitution is going to be like the Americans, because that was a phenomenal what they did. There were constitutions all over the world, especially through the Americas, that were formed like that. Formed like our constitution, took our phrases out of our constitution and wrote their own in the Spanish tongue. For example, the Mexican Constitution of 1824. Well, the trouble with that was it never worked. They invited 20,000 Anglos, they called them. That's Americans, American Anglos, came to Texas on the promise that Mexico would enforce and recognize their Constitution of 1824, which was substantially like ours, a common law document. Well, of course, didn't last long, and pretty soon the Anglos went to war with the Mexicans and overthrew their rule and established a new country called Texas, which eventually became a state of the United States. Why did that happen? That happened because even though the Mexicans put that in place, you see, that wasn't enough. Oh, we'll pass a piece of paper. We'll sign a piece of paper that says this is our law. That doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work was because in the heart of their hearts, down in their deepest recesses of their beings, they accepted the idea of a dictator for government. What's the deepest recesses of men's beings? It is their religion. It is their religion. Our Supreme Court has recognized that's what religion is. It goes to the ultimate questions, the things that go to the ultimate questions of human existence. That's one definition they put on it. That's not the only one, but that's a good way to look at it. Well, in Mexico, the people there, almost to a man and a woman, put the questions of the ultimate questions of human existence upon one man called the Pope of Rome. And they were comfortable with his dictatorship in the heart and of their hearts. So they're also comfortable with a dictatorship in their country. That's why every country in South America has always been that way. They are comfortable with that kind of a one-man show government called a dictator, God, claiming the power of Jesus Christ, by the way, on earth. That's what he claims. That's just one example. I'm not picking him. I pick him out because he's so visible. But he claims to stand in the place of Jesus Christ on earth. That's the very definition of Antichrist, according to John the Apostle. He uses that word four times in his writings, in his epistles. So we come back to America. Well, why did it work in America? It did not work in Mexico. It does not work in South America. It doesn't work anywhere in the world unless the common law informs the document, such as the United States Constitution. And don't think for a minute that the useful idiots of the evil empire are not full force and have been for a long time, but they're picking up steam to do away with any connection of our common law with this common law document. The Supreme Court has even said, I think of the statements of Chief Justice Taft, you cannot understand the Constitution. You can't apply it unless you see and learn that it is informed by our common law. It's not even possible, because the men that drafted the Constitution of the United States, and even more important than them, too much emphasis put on them, why did they say what they said and did what they did? Because they knew nothing else would be accepted. It is the ratifiers of the militiamen, the people, the militiamen of the several states that said, yes, we accept that. They did accept it because they saw that it was a common law document. And they also saw that because it was a common law document, that their authority was not slighted in the least. That's why they accepted it. And that's what we as Americans now, that's what we must understand. But here's our problem. Chief Justice Taft said that these men in those days, they breathed the atmosphere of the common law. It was who they were. They didn't know anything else. And because they did, when they went to put, as he said, I'm quoting him, he who never quotes is never quoted, in compact draft, when they put their ideas of common law in compact draft, the Constitution of the United States, all of those words and phrases came through. It doesn't. Our Constitution of the United States does not define the jury. It does not define the dollar. It does not define due process. It does not. Well, it doesn't define anything. Nothing. Why doesn't it? Because all of those words didn't need definition. They freighted with them all of our common law. When it comes to trial by jury, you just don't say, well, I want trial by jury and leave it at that, as they do in the other countries. They've tried this. It doesn't work. Why? Because there are many things that the common law says that a jury has to have and be, and the processes you have to follow in order for it to be the jury that God wants. Now, that's another subject. How do we connect? Is the common law part of Christianity? And the answer is yes, and we can talk about that. It is wrong to say, I must say this, I want to spit this out for discussion if somebody wants to talk about it. Our common law is not based upon the Bible. Watch me. Our common law is not based upon the Bible. No. Our common law stands on its own two feet. The Bible stands on its own two feet. And those two volumes, the one written and the other unwritten, are direct from our Maker. Psalm chapter 19 lays that out clear as crystal, as does the rest of the Bible. In cases where there is a misunderstanding or an apparent contradiction, what is the final rule? The principles of the written and particular revelation of God are the final rule. Our common law, you see, is not written. It is the observations of men. The observations of men, and where they agree, they may write it down, as they have done in our common law world for centuries. And Magna Carta is a good example of what men agreed upon as right and wrong in their observations. And all of this, as our common law has always said, anything that claims to be our common law that is contrary to the Bible is not part of our common law. And there's been plenty of pronouncements of men that have claimed, and that's why our Constitution, by the way, says, well, it can be amended and changed. That hasn't worked out the way we want. Why? Because the Constitution is not the Bible. It's not the expiration of the breath of God in speech, as Peter puts it. It is not the theopneumatos. It is men's observations put in our own tongue. And God wants that because this is the day of the government of men, says Paul the Apostle. That the day will come when the Messiah will have all authority and presence. Right now, his parousia, his kingly presence, is not with us. And he has delegated, Romans chapter 13 and following, he has delegated that authority to men right now. And it's up to us to see to it and to flesh out the first principles, Hebrews chapter 5, the first principles of God's written revelation, and make sure that what we say in our common law pronouncements, court decisions, and anything else we say, even in our daily lives, in our families, the law of the father and the law of the mother, as Proverbs puts it, these things are sacred. These are our common law. What is our common law? Number one, it is not a list of laws. Well, then what is it? It's a way of life. Well, W-A-Y.
So Mr. Winters, before we, maybe it would be really helpful if you could get to help us understand the origins of common law, because obviously you've been talking about it in a historical context back to the New Testament time. The origins of common law are, and I think that was kind of tying to what you were just describing as the way, but starting off with that fundamental basis of how common law came to be, because one of the things that I find amazing in academia and in the education process, we've been taught that the acknowledgement of property in what they call several law, which, as you know, is Roman law. Several law was argued that, as there are, I should say, academics are arguing that several law was the first acknowledgement and recognition of property, several property, that you own that property. And I contend that property was acknowledged by law in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal, which means you know what your property is and you know what somebody else's property is. And anyway, so laws obviously go all the way back to the Mosaic time, but I believe they even go back beyond that. And so the origins of common law are, and that's where you can fill in the blank.
The origins of common law are the mind of the eternal maker of heaven and earth. Genesis 26 tells us this before the laws called the laws delivered through Moses, the ten davarims. They're not really commandments. They're words. They're principles. They're not in the imperative mode, even. One of them is. The fifth commandment we call them commandments for lack of a better word. It's in the imperative mode, but they are standards. That's different than a raw imperative. Do this. Don't do that. And if even in our English translations, we see The translators struggle with getting the Hebrew and something that the Hebrew into the English that makes some congruent sense of the Hebrew. We don't say, don't kill. That's a command in English. We don't translate that way. The translators have chosen to say in the popular translations, thou shalt not kill. It's a future indicative in the English. That's not a command. Now, in a military context, that's a command. If the gunnery sergeant or the chief or the drill sergeant says, you will salute, you see, that's a future indicative. Well, in that context, that can be looked at as a command. But strictly speaking, the technicality of the language, that's a future indicative. And the Ten Commandments are principles. And that's important to understand for many reasons. I mentioned it in passing. Let me get to the origins of the common law. And I appreciate you bringing that up. Of course, I appreciate your guidance in the discussion. The true, if something is true law and it's right, it's from the maker of heaven and earth. He is eternal. It's from his mind. That's why James says in the New Testament, there is only one true lawgiver, the final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal. That's called a God. And our God, the true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as some people like to distinguish him, that's a good way to do it, that way you know. Our forebears are Anglo and Saxon and even Celtic forebears chose to call him the good one to distinguish him. That's not really what those the Hebrew and the Greek word mean. The Hebrew and the Greek word, Elohim in the Old Testament, El in the singular, Theos in the New Testament, those words mean lawgiver. But they chose to distinguish him by calling him the good one. Why? Well, they found out when they got the scriptures, Jesus Christ said, there is none good but God, none. Paul the Apostle says, Romans chapter 1, there is none good. No, they have all gone out of the way. The poison of asps is under their lips, etc. They're full of dead men's bones. That's me and you, by the way. He said that. And so they said, well, how do we denominate? How do we distinguish this Christian God, this God of creation? They said, well, we'll call him the good one because there isn't anybody else that's good. So that's why we say God. We've contracted it to God. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not really what the words mean. And it's important that we go back and say, now, wait a minute. What do these words mean that the Hebrew text of the Old Testament uses and the Greek, Koine Greek text of the New Testament uses? And what they mean is lawgiver. That's what those words mean fundamentally. And so we go back. He's lawgiver. What right and wrong is eternal. It never changes. The first principles of it. We go to Genesis chapter 26. Long before the Ten Commandments came down to Mount Sinai, delivered, and all of the rest of the written law of God, which can be categorized under those ten headings with overlap in a lot of places. But those ten headings are everything in fundamental, compact, to use the words of compact draft. Hebrews 5 calls them, this is in the English, this is a good translation, unwrought rudiments. Unwrought rudiments. I think that's the best translation. What does that mean? That means first principles that are delivered not by delegation, but direct from the hand of God. Indeed, those 10 first principles, God wrote them direct with his own finger on stone, engraved them into the stone with his own finger. Two other times in the written revelation of God, we see the hand of God doing that. And those three are important to understand. But it's eternal. So you go back to Genesis 26. It says that Abraham, long before the Ten Commandments were delivered, Abraham was faithful to the law of God. The commandments, it says, the statutes, the judgments. Well, we can go back at least that far. But then when we look at our Maker, the Maker of all things, we see that he is eternal. His mind is eternal. He is the same yesterday, Hebrews chapter 13, yesterday, today, and forever. Now, in that context, he's referring specifically to the priesthood of Melchizedek. But along with the priesthood of Melchizedek becomes the will of God. Let's define this quickly, if I may. What is law? Oh, I want to talk about that, if you'll let me. Can I talk about that just a minute?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. What is law? Law, let me try to get the ball out and not hide it and then talk about it just a minute. Law is the way things are and they won't change. Now that's one way to say it. The way things are and they won't change. Again, the folk that gave us our tongue, the Anglo-Saxon tongue, which is also a Danish tongue. The Angels, the Saxons, and the Jutes, the Danes, they were all there together on the Jutland Peninsula. And they were the ones that came to the Britain Island, the British Island, and settled and took over, and they warred with each other. They were essentially the same folk, just three different tribes. And then they eventually mixed their blood after Alfred the Great. The Danes are the Vikings, properly speaking. They were the Scandinavian people that are the Vikings. The rest of the Scandinavians, including the Anglos, the Saxons, and the Norwegians, and the Swedes, they were all just as nasty, all just as sordid. As William Blackstone says, they were all just a piratical people. And that's a mild way of putting it. But they warred with one another, but they all wound up over there. The Danes gave us our word law, L-A-W. It was very similar, as they say here in the wall of Bash Valley, very similar to the speech of the angels. The Saxons, all three, were Germanic, a strain of Germanic speech. That's what our English tongue is. And the word law the Danes gave us, they were an earthy folk like the Anglos and the Saxons. Their words were all, and still are, one syllable, maybe two, but mostly one and two syllable words, punchy words like burn, or as the Latins would say, conflagrate. That's a weak way to talk. They said guts, where the Greek speaker would say splagna. That's a weak way to say it. And this is true of all the Anglo-Saxon tongue. It's very much like the Hebrew in that respect. Most Hebrew words are one and two syllables, with some three, but very gutsy, very earthy. And when they said law, they were talking about something they understood that was right down to the ground. What was it? Well, our word log, L-O-G, is the same root. L-O-G came from the Danes and Anglos and Saxons, but direct from the Danes. Log, L-O-G. What was a log? Well, when you say something like, that something is waterlogged. What does that mean? That means it's heavy. Have you ever tried to pick up a log? A fallen piece of timber that was logged with water. I've tried it. I've had some terrible bouts with that kind of stuff. Cutting wood out in the woods. When I was home, when I was living down on the home place and we had to heat with wood, I'd be out in the woods. We sold timber. They'd come up from Tennessee and they'd want to buy timber, white oak and red oak, for their barrels, you see, for the staves of their barrels. And they'd cut down the best trees, white oak and red oak, and then they would just take 6 foot out of the butt of those big, beautiful trees, and they'd let the rest of it lay, and they'd pay good for it. Well, a lot of that laying out in the woods at home. And all those tops, we called them, but they were good wood, too. Good burning wood, hardwood, but those things that lay there for years. And, of course, you didn't want to saw them up for firewood until they'd had 3 or 4 years to dry out. And those things that lay there 3, 4, 10 years, they were beautiful for firewood. But they'd get logged up, too. They were heavy. Water logged. Well, the word log to the Dane meant something heavy. That's what a log is. A log is not a sliver of wood. It's not a rune, as they used to say. It is a heavy, substantial piece of timber. Well, our word law is from the Danes, and what it means is that which is immovable, that which is unchangeable, that which never changes. And to them, it never changed. And by the way, their ancient pagan religion, the religion of even King Alfred, he converted to Christianity. Their religion, their god of their religion, was called, in the old Germanic speech, Vierd. Vierd, with a V as in victor. Vierd? Yeah, we still got that word too. We just soften it up because we've had softening influences in our Germanic English. And we don't call it Vierd, we call it Weird. Our V changes to W. And we still have substantially the same meaning to the word weird. That's weird.
So
what that means is that we can't control that. That's out of our control. Go ahead.
So let me interrupt, because I want to kind of. So you're making a great tie that there were different cultures. Obviously, the culture of Israel, the culture or ancient man in Israel, the new pagan culture of the European nations. was there something equivalent within, and I'll just use the term, Orient in the Far East, where China, Japan, and so forth, did they also have something similar? They, obviously, they wouldn't have used the same language, but was there something else that also created this foundation of law and common law in that culture as well?
Well, that's good. Of course, the common law is the law common to all men, but most men reject it by almost across the board. But there are indications of it even in the Far East and among the Chinese people. And what it comes down to is this. Consider, for instance, what we call today the Lord's Prayer. Jesus Christ says, he's teaching his learners how to pray, the 12-man jury, by the way, that he impaneled. 12, significant number. Why? That's important to understand. It was a 12-man jury. He impaneled. Just grab 12 men standing around as we do it in our common law juries today, and they were to be witnesses of the evidence. Witnesses of the evidence, that's what a jury is. Sworn witnesses of the evidence of his messiahship. He grabbed them. He taught them how to pray, and it wasn't a prayer he could pray intelligently because he says, forgive us our debts. Well, Jesus Christ didn't have any sins or debts. He was teaching them how to pray. So properly speaking, it wasn't the Lord's Prayer. It was the disciples' prayer. But he said, pray this way, thy kingdom, that's your jurisdiction arrangement, the arrangement of right and authority, thy kingdom, basileia, come, thy will be done on land as it is in the skies. Now, the popular versions say, on earth as it is in heaven. That word for earth, that just means land. And the word heaven, that's an okay translation, but it's a little too literary for me. He's raw speaker too. He meant sky. Thy kingdom, thy authority, thy arrangement of authority is what a kingdom is. Basileia in the Greek text. Thy arrangement of authority come to land. Thy will be done on land as it is in the sky. Well, here's what the Chinese believed. I'm trying to remember the name of the religious point of view on that point. It's a Chinese word. Starts with a T. I won't venture it. Doesn't make any difference. But what they believed was that the law arose from the land. The law arose from the land. What does that mean? That means it's land law, Magna Carta. Okay. Lex terra, land law. Constitution of the United States lifted from that. Law of the land. Same fundamental thing. But all law, from God's perspective, comes from the skies, comes to the land, and there we apply it. It is the law of the land. And everything comes back to the land. Go ahead.
Okay, so thank you. I'm just trying to put it in context because I actually purport that from Adam and Eve, from the beginning of mankind that we know it, that his children actually went in different directions, that if the law was given to Adam, because clearly God did command Adam very specific things, and so there had to have been, and there's evidence that he was given law, that fundamental commonality actually had to exist in some of these different cultures that arose, such as the Hindu or the Indian culture, and then the Far East culture, and obviously you've already talked about ancient Israel or that Middle East, as well as the Western culture that kind of merged, I believe, the Mediterranean, the Israel laws and those definitions into Rome, which then Rome perverted into civil law.
Oh, no question. I quote he who never quotes is never quoted. That's a quote, by the way, and it's one of my favorite quotes.
Okay.
Coming back to Bago. Now, Bago was one of those fellows that lived in England. He was a common lawyer. His name Bago was French. Again, that was a vestige of what the Norwegians had picked up on the coast of France when they invaded. But he was a common lawyer in England in the last century. No, we got to go back another century. I'm getting older. Back in the 1800s. And he made this comment. He said that all the peoples of earth have the vestiges and the inclination even to understand what is true law. But what they have all lacked and continue to lack is the power to make it happen. The power to consistently follow it. What did he mean? He meant that, and he said this, of course, they didn't have Jesus Christ. They did not submit themselves to the Messiah of mankind. They did not recognize his authority. And there's a progression that Paul the Apostle lays out in Romans chapter 1 as to how that deplorable state of circumstances comes to exist. But yes, men know, they have an inkling of it, even in the Roman Empire. When the Roman Empire started, they came close in their understanding to setting up a government. Emperorship didn't come really strong, you see, until Caesar and the man that was just before him, you can look it up. But I won't go into all that because I get sidetracked too easy and I get on these rabbit trails. And they're good rabbit trails, but they diverge from maybe where we want to go or where you're trying to take it.
Right.
So just to say this, Rome understood, but Rome tried it. They tried some of the first principles of what we'd call common law. It didn't last. Why? Because without the redemptive power of Jesus Christ and without his presence, lo, I am with you always. Is he bodily here? No, but he says, I will send the person of the gumption breath of God, the person of the gumption breath of God. I believe that's the best translation. We call it today the Holy Spirit. That's a Latin word. That means nothing to us. What does that mean? It means gumption breath, to put it in our own tongue. That's what he sends to be with us, and that gumption breath at the new birth is what infuses the man, the woman of God, to desire hard and to have the persistence to obey their maker. Without that, you can know it. You cannot do it. You cannot do it. And the natural man, natural, yes, the physical man, without the infusion of the Spirit of God to come to reside through the new birth, you become a new creature. All that changes. But that does not mean that the rest of humanity is stupid as a matter of their minds. No, they see those things, but they reject them. They will not. They do not have the power. Oh, how I've seen this over and over again. They do not have the power. The Christian man, the man born from above, has the choice to do right. The non-Christian man does not even have the choice to do right. He can try it. It won't work. What does he have the choice to do? A whole lot of wrong things. That's what he has a choice to do. And that was one of the great points of what Martin Luther said was the greatest writing he ever wrote, called Bondage of the Will. I understand that. By the way, I'm not a Lutheran. I'm not a Lutheran. But the Reformers all understood that. And I find Martin Luther had a lot of important things to say. By the way, not to go down that trail, so I'll hush my tongue right now, and we'll talk about whatever you guide us to talk about next.
Okay, that's perfect, because we, believe it or not, we've actually ran out of time. We're 40 minutes into this, and so we need to curtail it at this point, but if you would please hang on so we could do another segment. What I want to do is, because I look at things in a macro view, and I see how common law was the sharing of power with all mankind. And I looked at civil law in a macro perspective of the exercising of power of those who possess the power over others, government and so forth. And so what's interesting, and this is what I want to get into, is common law, and I believe that there had to be traces of this in every society, of how they established their laws and how they dealt with people, which came from the origins of mankind, Adam and Eve, and the original family. With that, over time, I see how we kind of digressed away from, but here's the miracle, and here's the interesting thing. If you look at Europe, when Europe became, we understand the cradle of civilization and these concepts of liberty, freedom, and those types of things, even though they weren't new to the world, they were well within the writings of the Bible and Israel and so forth. The Western society, spawned from these philosophies and concepts of Greece, and as it went into the Roman Empire, and how the Roman Empire conquered the world with its laws, the thing that's just amazing to me is how we, as the European culture, basically rejected Rome, they went back to the roots of common law. Just how we've been able to revitalize that whole concept and how it became a fundamental foundation. Now, I don't think that the Western society of Europe successfully overcame that, because you still see, and today, Europe is practicing civil law. They do not practice common law. And so, we'll get into those types of details. Again, we're out of time, and I pray that you can give us another segment so we can get into this aspect of this. Do you have the time?
Without question. And matter of fact, I'm getting another cup of coffee.
Okay.
I'll be sitting here talking and relaxing. I'm enjoying talking.
Okay. Let's take a break. You go get a piece. You go get your cup of coffee, and we'll reconvene. So, folks, we will be right back, and I will give you a summation, and then the next segment will be in our following episode. So, thank you very much, Mr. Winters, and folks. Again, like I said, we will be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Okay, so I have put Brent Winters' contact information, where to buy his books, and so forth, right there on the Red State Talk radio podcast page. I'm not going to try to even summarize the biography. Obviously, this is just part one. We have a second part to this, and we will be contacting him soon to dive further into common law so that you can understand where we are, what we need to do, and how we go about restoring common law back into our government, into your county, into your state, and into the federal government. The fact of the matter is, we're going to get into the details of what has happened and so forth. He has a plethora of knowledge, and obviously you can tell he's a good lawyer because he's a good orator and a good statesman. I felt bad that I had to keep on interrupting him, but anyway, as you'll see in the next part, we're going to move forward in discussing more on common law, and I want to summarize to really kind of give you bullet points of what needs to really happen so that we can get our legal system back on two solid, 2 feet planted in the ground, so we can stand up on our fundamental legal system that the framers and that we have had for centuries, and it has been obfuscated, and we have literally been duped into believing that our legal system is something else. So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we'll be back with part two of this series in our next episode. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.